Okay, so I'll be presenting the F8 architecture. For those who've been to last year's talk, the first few slides with the motivational introduction will be familiar, and but we'll get into some more details then. Now the F8 is an 8/16-bit architecture. Now, why do we still bother with 8/16-bit architectures? Well, the main point is they are still used in huge numbers in a large number of devices. Even the laptops most of us are carrying with us tend to have an 8051, which is an 8-bit core, as a keyboard controller or somewhere deeply within the Wi-Fi chip. For example, the Realtek Wi-Fi chips do contain 8051 cores. Now, in general, there's even 4-bit microcontrollers in use sometime. Well, bought a cyclocomputer for my bike, took it apart, turns out there's a 4-bit microcontroller in it. And of course, there's the familiar 32-bit 64, which are now dominated by ARM and probably soon RISC-V. But there's still these areas of 8/16-bit, where the 32-bit devices are too big, not just in terms of their core, but also in terms for memory requirements, both for program and data storage. Now, these low-end 8/16-bit architectures are typically programmed in C. They are not that expensive. The typical range is about a cent to a euro. So if some of them are a bit cheaper or more expensive. The data memory tends to be in the range of, well, about 60, 70 bytes to about the same number of kilobytes. And the program memory tends to be a few kilobytes, typically something like 4 to 128 kilobytes of program memory. The market is dominated on one hand by proprietary architectures like the STM8 by STMicroelectronics, and then these ancient things like 8051 or some Z80 derivatives and such, where all patents have long expired. We don't have like a good modern free architecture. Yeah? And in the 32-64-bit market, we have RISC-V, which is doing very well, but we don't really have this free architecture that has enough momentum in the 8/16-bit area, and that's what I'm trying to change with the F8. Now, a little bit of background. The small device C compiler is a C compiler targeting 8-bit systems. In particular, architectures that are hard to target in Clang and GCC due to their irregularities. It's a compiler. There's the other tools you need, like assembler, linker, simulator around. It works on a variety of host systems. It targets quite a lot of different 8-bit architectures. It has optimizations that make sense for these 8-bit architectures, such as a register allocator that can deal with irregularities, get slow for a large number of registers, which would be a problem if you use this in GCC or Clang, but is fine for 8-bit architectures with a small number of registers. The user group is embedded systems microcontroller programmers and a few retro computing enthusiasts, because, well, old 8-bit architectures are supported too, not just the current ones. Now, I'm a developer of the small device C compiler. And what I learned about the 8-bit architectures we're targeting, what makes sense, what makes them a good target for a C compiler, a lot of that experience, of course, went into the design of the F8. And a really important point is you want an efficient stack pointer relative addressing mode. Yeah? You put your local variables, you want to put them on the stack, because that's how you do re-entrant functions in C. If you don't have it, either you have to give up re-entrancy by default. That's what you typically do when targeting the 8051. Only make those functions re-entrant where the programmer or user really says, okay, I need recursion, or indirectly or directly, or I need it re-entrant because I want to call it from an interrupt controller. But if you have an efficient stack pointer relative addressing mode, then everything becomes much easier and you can do the right thing, and it's an efficient thing to do. Then you want a unified address space. Yeah? You want to have, say, okay, this pointer, and you have your instruction for pointer access, and that's it. You don't want to say, okay, this pointer, now let's look at the top bits. Now we do a switch statement with 5 different cases, depending on which address space it is, I need to use a different instruction, like you do have on, let's say, the 8051 or quite some other of the less elegant 8-bit architectures. Next point is, it helps to have registers. The experience shows that the STM8, for example, with its stack pointer relative addressing mode and unified address space, it's a bit lacking in registers, so there's a few corner cases where even an old Z80 can be more efficient. So you don't need a lot of registers, but having some really helps with code generation. Then the experience from the PDORC devices is that, yes, you can replace peripheral hardware by having an extra core or an extra hardware thread where you're emulating your peripheral device and then do that in real time because it's this extra core, it's not bothered by the rest of the system. But you need to think it fully through and you want it supported at the C level. Yeah? The PDORC devices, they're typically programmed in assembler and you notice in the instruction set that, for example, C11 atomics do not map nicely to that instruction set. So you want support for these multi-threading and atomics and thread local storage in your instruction set so you can both program those things in C and be able to not use a lot of your die space for peripherals. The point about the irregular architectures is we have a register allocator that can deal with it well and then they are fine for code generation. Now DCC with its, or Clang with their typically Chitin style graph coloring register allocators can't deal with irregular architectures well. Yeah? They want kind of a RISC architecture. Every instruction should have its register operands and it shouldn't matter which register it is. Yeah? If you have an instruction, it should be available for all registers and should have the same cost. But if the number of registers is low and we have small targets, it's fine to deal with the irregularities. You want a good mixture of 8 and 16-bit operations because you want to do 8-bit, where you don't need more than 8-bit because you have little memory, but an 8-bit address space would be totally insufficient. Yeah, you need a 16-bit address space and therefore pointers are 16 bits and then ints are 16-bit and in C a lot of stuff gets promoted to int. Often you can optimize it out, but not always. So you need to be able to deal with 16-bit stuff. And yes, as I said, joint pointers should be 16 bits and we want the unified address space, so a pointer is a 16-bit value in memory and we can use it directly and we don't have like an upper byte that is a tag for which address space it points to and then makes it 24-bit or things like that. And getting to a few more details, the experience is that zero-page addressing that many 8-bit architectures have is actually not that useful. Sure, you can use this as kind of a scratchpad memory, but the savings are relatively small. You save an address byte in your instruction, so it makes the instruction a little bit shorter, but the user has to decide what goes into that zero-page or scratchpad memory. It's much better to just have the stack pointer relative addressing mode be efficient, and then the local variables are the ones that we can access efficiently. Index pointer relative read instructions for both 8 and 60-bit offsets are important, particularly if you like using accessing structs or union. Yeah, you want to be able to here's the pointer to the struct, now get this member. And prefix bytes, which some 8-bit architectures have, can actually be a relatively good way to allow additional operands. We want our instructions to be very compact. We can't afford like a classic RISC format with opcode, target operand, left operand, right operand, because that results in big instructions. We want short instructions. And if we want to use different operands, then, well, we do the rare cases via prefix bytes, so only the instructions that actually do unusual stuff get longer. That means we don't have the RISC principle of every instruction the same length, but we tend to have different instruction lengths. In terms of multiplication, yes, hardware multipliers are expensive, but the cheapest one, the 8 times 8 to 16, is actually already quite useful, because first you can build bigger multiplications out of it, and second, the very common case of array indexing is such a multiplication. Yeah, you have an array of structs. The struct has an odd size because we don't want to part it to multiples of 64 bits or anything, because again, we don't have enough memory. So 5-byte struct, we need to do a multiplication by 5 on the array access. And that is substantially sped up by this multiplication. On the other hand, the other multiplicative operators, such as division and remainder, are relatively rare. So it tends to be not worth to actually have them in hardware. On the other hand, having a multiply and add instruction can substantially speed up byte multiplications. Because you have the multiplier, which is already costly, and you want to use it efficiently because you are paying that hardware cost. And then ideally you want to, if you're doing like a big multiplication, 64-bit, you want to do them, use the multiplier as often as possible and not spend all your time shuffling data around to make it available to the multiplier and then store it away. So having a dedicated multiply and add instruction helps a lot there. And after all, multiplications are not just for the small ones important for the array indexing, but also for things like cryptography. Yeah? Classic things like RSA do multiply big numbers, and if we go into the post-quantum area, let's say the number theoretic transform of the Kyber key exchange also does a lot of multiplications. binary coded decimal. At first one thinks that's just a dinosaur from the past, and as a data format it actually is. However, we said division is rarely used, but still people often want to print out numbers in decimal. And then being able to convert a number to BCD and then to ASCII is like a cheaper alternative to dividing by 10. So having a little bit of BCD support in the hardware is actually useful for this use case of outputting numbers in decimal. Yes, and we want good support for shift and rotations, because again, these are common when you're shuffling bits close to the hardware. If you some maybe need a floating point somewhere, need to emulate it in software, or also in cryptography. So, where do we get there? Big picture, 8 16-bit architecture. This will be an irregular CISC architecture, because on the RISC side we don't get the code density we want. That means that the core gets somewhat bigger, yeah, because we have some more complex instructions and instruction decode, but we are saving a lot on the code memory, because we are, our code is much more compact. And then, because we've seen there's very low-end devices as well, I also want to define an instruction subset where the core becomes even smaller. This is this F8L variant, where the core is only about half the size of the others, but for example then the instruction that does not have a multiplication at all. Now looking at the details, this is basically the register set I came up with. Sure, we need a program counter, we need a stack pointer, the 16 bits. This architecture uses a flag register with flag bits, meaning we are not directly don't have a direct compare and jump instructions, but rather we do a comparison first, which sets flags in the flag register, and then we jump depending on those. And then we have our general purpose registers. And in this case, there's basically three 16-bit general purpose registers, which each consist of two 8-bit registers. Basically, this is built up from the experience from the 8-bit target supported, such as the STM8, such as the Z80 and all the Z80 derivatives and so on. And now, which might not be perfectly visible, that XL and Y are actually in bold, because those are kind of accumulators. Yeah, CISC architectures often have so-called accumulator registers where many instructions implicitly operate on that one, or only support that one as source and destination operand. And then you have these prefix bytes that I mentioned before if you want to use a different register instead. So typically an addition will be something like take the value in the accumulator, add something else to it, store the value into the accumulator. And by default for the 8-bit instruction we use XL as the accumulator and Y for the 16-bit instructions. If there's any questions on this, I think I'll try to leave time because It's really the number of registers, and having them as these two halves is really based on this experience from the STM8, where we do have an 8-bit accumulator, for example, and two 16-bit registers as pointer registers, but we can't really use anything else as 8-bit registers, versus, for example, the Z80, where we actually do have a similar style of register pairs, where often a 16-bit register can be used as two 8-bit registers, and how this affected code generation. And since I've been talking about instructions, and if you're not familiar with this style of instructions, I thought we'd just do a typical example, yeah? There's different instruction classes in the F8. As usual for CISC architecture, one of them would be 8-bit instructions that have two operands. Again, the very first one, the ADC XL with another op, would be the typical case, which means it's an addition with carry. We take the value in XL, add a second operand and add the carry, store the result into XL, and also update the flags, even though it's not mentioned on the slide, such as the carry flag, to be able to build wider additions, such as the zero flag, to use this for equality comparisons and so on. And then the second operand, as typical in a CISC architecture, can't just be a register, but it also could be an immediate value or a value in memory, either directly addressed with a 16-bit address, relative to the stack pointer, using a stack pointer relative addressing mode, or an indexed addressing mode relative to another register. And the second and third lines here show how what variants we get if we use a prefix byte. Now the first one, prefix byte, is a prefix byte for swapping the two operands. So basically, instead of taking XL, adding something, storing it there, well, we use a location and add something else to it and store the result. And then, that's the third line, this one here I was talking about, yeah? We basically swap the two operands, yeah? Instead of having XL as a source and destination, we have the other thing as source and destination, we add XL to it. That basically allows us to use one of the other registers or a memory location like we'd use the accumulator before. Sure, it has a prefix byte, this instruction costs more, but it allows us to make better use of the other registers, and allowing to even have a memory operand means we can use this as an atomic instruction. Not that important for an 8-bit addition with carry, but in general, in business, if you want an atomic addition and to have it directly operate on the memory operand, that is how you can do it efficiently. Okay, now after the second line, we just change the XL via a different one. So instead of swapping the two operands and having XL as the right operand, we still have the right operand like before, but instead of XL as the accumulator, we use a different register. Yeah? So for the second line, it's always a register. That's one of the source or destinations. Only for the swapped one, the very third one, can we actually have memory as a destination. It works similar with, let's say, the 16-bit instruction with two operands, or if you have an 8-bit instruction with just one operand, like a rotation or shift instruction. Well, then of course it doesn't make sense to swap operands, but you still have the prefix byte where you replace the XL accumulator by one of the different registers or even a memory operand. Typically, in the compiler, then you keep commonly accessed values in registers, but if you're running out of registers, for example, it makes sense to have a decrement that works directly on the memory for your loop counter if your loop counter is not accessed much inside the loop otherwise. So I was already mentioned that there's other instructions, so the rough instruction set overviews. We have these 8-bit two-operand instructions where we saw the example. We have the one-operand instructions like a decrement or a shift. Similar instructions exist 16-bit wide, not as many, but still enough that we can work well with integers and with pointers. And then, of course, there's the load instructions, where we are moving data around between registers and memory, or even in some corner cases between memory and memory. And then there's the special case ones, the other 8-bit instructions, other 16-bit instructions, typically you always have a few instructions that you need for stuff that doesn't really fit into the other categories, like a sign extension instruction, especially in the 8-16-bit area. You're often working with both 8 and 16-bit data. If you want to convert the signed 8 to 16-bit, it takes a few instructions to properly sign extend, so having a dedicated instruction for that is nice. Or something like this multiply and add instruction, which gets more complicated. That would be an example of one of the other instructions. And so forth, the jumps, yeah? Unconditional jumps, conditional jumps depending on the flag register, instructions to call subroutines, to return from them, like put the program counter on the stack, and so on. Yes, to make the hardware implementation a bit easier, all instructions do have write at most one 16-bit register and one 16-bit memory location. They can read multiple registers and read one memory location. So the idea is that you can, in hardware, implement this with a dual port RAM and a single port program memory. And to be able to use memory efficiently and not need any padding bytes, there's no alignment requirements, meaning the architecture allows 16-bit loads and stores to any address, not just to even ones, which again makes the hardware a bit more complicated, but it saves a lot in terms of memory then. And there's actually a few safety and security features which from a perspective of a bigger microcontroller are, of course, nothing particular fancy. I mean, on a RISC or an ARM, you have write or execute things and such. We don't have that. But I've put in a few basic stuff. The classic watchdog you want on a microcontroller, meaning if the system hangs, you have a mechanism to restart it. Basically, it's a counter that counts down or up, and when it reaches a set value, it just resets the machine. And then your software, you tell the watchdog to be quiet for a while all the time, and if you don't do it too long, the system assumes that it was hanging, and then it just restarts. The second one is actually wrong, what I wrote there. Writes to address 0 do trap, not reads. So if you attempt for some reason a null pointer ends up somewhere where you write it, you don't get random undefined behavior, but you get a proper reset via a trap reset. And similar, if you the zero instruction, the opcode, that's all 0 bits, is also a trap. Classically, this is often a no-op. And in many exploits, this is used because memory is often 0, things are often initialized to 0 before they're used. And if you manage to start executing some data, it's all no-ops until you get to a point where you have your gadget that you can use to build your exploit. But if the no-op 0 instruction is actually a trap instruction that resets the system, this relatively common attack style doesn't work anymore. And of course, after a reset, we have some bits in the reset controller set. So after reset, you can check what was the reset, was it a power-on reset, was it a watchdog reset, was it a trap reset. So, basically, that's what I wanted to say about the details of the architecture so far. But if I have extra time, I'll use it to quickly show the opcode map. But let's just get to the current state. So there's an F8 port and also an F8L port in SDCC, the small device C compiler. So we have a working C toolchain for the architecture. I've written Verilog implementations of the F8, two of the F8, one of the F8L. More as proof of concept, I'm not really a CPU designer, even though I have a little bit of computer architecture background. One a bit more optimized for speed, the other one more for size. There's a GitHub repository with the architecture manual and some tutorials on how to get started on some common FPGA boards, for example, the Lattice ICE40 ones, or the I think Govin, running on Govin and on the Cologne chips GateMate. So the ones that tend to have free toolchains. I didn't bother trying another. There's, of course, the website of the small device C compiler. And while the instruction set is fixed by now, I'm still shuffling the opcode map around a bit, mostly automated to see what the synthesis tools can use very well to make the core a little bit smaller. So we'll probably see in the next few months the opcode map being fixed and then the assembler and simulators being updated accordingly. Okay, so that's for my talk slides. Now if you want to see the, I hope it's readable even from the back a bit. we have, well, maybe I can zoom in a bit. Oop. Ah, yeah, I see it. Thanks. Better? Okay, so on the upper left, of course, we have the trap instruction. As I said, 0 is a trap. Then we have the typical 2 operand 8 bits. Yeah, I used the addition with carry as example, but there you see the subtraction, subtraction with carry, addition, addition with carry. The comparison with it, which is essentially the same as subtraction, but it doesn't write its destination. It's just for checking things in an if condition or in a switch statement. The usual bitwise operations AND or XOR. The next come the one operand 8-bit instructions, such as the shifts, right shift, left shift, rotations, increment, decrement, clearing, so setting to 0, and just testing, setting the flag bits depending on the value. Now you see the first yellow ones here. The yellow ones are F8 instructions that are not in the simplified F8L subset. And when we now get to some 16-bit instructions, you see that a lot of them are F8 only. Then we have a set of load instructions. Next comes the exotic things, not really exotic, but the ones that doesn't fit into another category, like the exchange instruction up there, which swaps the two operands atomically again. The gray ones, by the way, are these instruction prefixes that I mentioned before. And then, 16-bit loads, LDW, anything ending in W is a 16-bit instruction, essentially. And we also have 16-bit XOR and OR, because these are relatively common in cryptography, and the OR also in bit shuffling. They're actually both quite a bit more common than a need for a 16-bit AND instruction. Because a lot of real-world uses of AND operators in C, you do something like, I take this with an AND mask and that with an AND mask and do stuff with it and then OR it together. By the time we OR it together, we really need an OR instruction. By the time we did the AND, one of them was still a literal operand where typically one byte was either fully 1 or fully 0, so it gets optimized into an 8-bit AND anyway. Then there's the conditional jumps, the sign extension stuff, and multiply and add and so on. Now looking down a bit, this is basically the first page of the opcode map. And if you use one of the prefix bytes, then you get into something like this. This is the one for swapping operands. You can see now for subtraction, the XL is on the right side. And the other operand is one of the other types. And then instead of the swap operand prefix, we also then have, of course, the other pages for one of the other prefixes. In this case, the XL 8-bit accumulator gets replaced by the XH register for this prefix byte, or down here now it's the YL and so on. So these other pages are just a prefix byte applied to an instruction which affects the operands, but otherwise they are the same. It's maybe the small exception of some conditional jumps, where it affects the condition that we are jumping on. Sorry, the conditional jumps I wanted to highlight are actually these here over there. So this is a jump on carry flag set, for example, instruction, jump on zero flag set instruction, and a few less common conditions are then moved to the next page.